KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview!
Coming up, a new tool used by the San Francisco District Attorney redacts race from police reports.
Race sometimes could be a descriptor. In order to identify somebody, but it should never be used as a predictor.
Then a new book chronicles the trauma that's pushed many of the city's vagabond youth to the streets.
They're still the same kids. They're still the same kids with the same kind of hurts.
And from Uncuffed, a former gang member tells his story.
I got jumped in, I got drunk, I got high, and one day I became a graduate, a drug addict, a gang member, and a murderer.
We'll hear the inside stories today on Cross Currents. African Americans are disproportionately arrested and prosecuted in San Francisco. District Attorney George Gascon wants to address that, so he's turning to artificial intelligence to keep bias from influencing prosecutors. The technology has captured headlines and imaginations, but how much of a difference can this new tool actually make? KALW's Ariella Markowitz and Holly J. McDeed investigate.
You've probably heard of implicit bias. Unconscious attitudes impact all of us, whether you're aware of it or not. And if you're curious about your own bias, of course, there's an online test you can take.
It's called the Implicit Association Test. It was created back in the 90s by a group of researchers. Ariella told me to take it.
Okay, eyes good, E bad.
Yeah.
Eye good, E bad.
White and black faces flashed across the screen. I needed to categorize the images, and it stressed me out a little. I was meant to hit I for white and E for black.
This person looks white. I. And this is so messed up.
The test asks you to classify words as good or bad. Words like cherish or beautiful are good, and words like disgusting or ugly are bad.
When a good word popped up, I had to press the same key for when I saw a white face. The same with the bad word and the black face. Then the rules changed. Black face is good, white face is bad.
Okay, bad, 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 good, 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 good. Okay.
Okay. Then we got the results.
Data suggests you have a slight automatic preference for black people over white people.
But I just feel like this is a game. It's leading me somewhere.
I don't buy that this online test can detect racial bias. But it did force me to think about unconscious stereotypes and how bias can impact decisions every day.
And that's really important for people like prosecutors who have to make split-second choices all the time.
They take on a lot of cases and have a really small window to decide whether to charge someone with a crime.
The process of self-awareness is really important. And frankly, as human beings, we're incapable of removing our biases.
San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon spends a lot of time thinking about ways to deal with implicit bias.
Before prosecutors decide whether to charge suspects, they look at police reports. And Gascon wondered what would happen if the suspect's race were removed from these documents.
But to do that by hand is very, very difficult, very time-consuming. So it became obvious to me, the more that I struggled with this, I said, well, you know, there is technology to do this kind of stuff. It's just a matter of figuring out who can be a partner.
So Gascon called up researchers at Stanford's Computational Policy Lab and pitched the idea. The product had to be economically feasible.
Which for government agencies, in this case, meant try to find something that was not going to cost us any money.
And the researchers thought the idea was great. So under a tight deadline, they designed software that does a bunch of things. It redacts name, race, and hair eye color of both the victims and the suspect.
Instead of saying Asian male, for example, the report says person one, and it's in purple or another rainbow color, so you can spot the same purple person throughout the report.
The software also takes out the neighborhood where the crime took place. And because it's open source, prosecutors outside San Francisco can pick it up too.
You know, the technology is not necessarily complex, it's just being able to get the data and do it.
Plus, it summarizes all police reports into one tidy digital document.
Before this, the docs weren't even digitized.
Prosecutors working on felony cases in the city are all using this new tool.
And Gascon is really excited about it.
So, you know, the goal is to sort of create a purity about our work that takes race out of the picture.
I almost feel like, are we outsourcing the very difficult and necessarily human task of unlearning racial bias to an algorithm?
Rebecca Young is the co-chair of the San Francisco Public Defender's Racial Justice Committee. She says relying on computers to address racial bias makes us lazy.
It just seems like an experiment or a game, almost, like some tech company was like, hey, try our artificial intelligence algorithm on rooting out implicit bias. No cost to you. Sounds like fun, right?
Young says she sees racial bias every day in jails and in the courtroom. She's witnessed prosecutors fight to remove black men from jury pools. And in San Francisco, African Americans are less likely to have their cases dropped than white suspects. She says this technology fails to address those disparities head on.
You still haven't taken care of the problem of the people in power making these decisions. You're not training, you're not requiring a growth in awareness and consciousness.
Gascon admits this software is snazzy and new and gets a lot of media people going, but he's also a prosecutor. And when you need to decide whether to charge a case right now, you need a tool to help you make the fairest decision as quickly as possible.
And this technology does give prosecutors a chance for some introspection. There is a second review process where attorneys see the original police report.
This is when they review material that does show race, like police body camera footage. If prosecutors change their minds after seeing all the info, they have to explain why. Gascon says that creates pressure to stick to the original colorblind decision.
We're making decisions that can impact people's life for many years or forever. I mean, you know, we can send somebody to prison for probably for their entire natural life, right?
In an ideal world, bias would be easy to unlearn. But when systematic racism exists, Gascon says ignoring your own bias doesn't work.
The problem is when you negate or you try to deny that you have them, and then you continue to act in a way that is contrary to what the best course of action should be for the community, for society, especially at work.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. When I took the implicit bias test online, I put a lot of energy into thinking about my own bias. I really wanted to come across as a decent person.
Oh, not this one again.
It's easy to stop and think about implicit bias when you're in front of a computer screen. But everyday decisions with real stakes are more complicated than online tests or computer software that redacts race for you.
But the technology still helps. It makes imperfect decisions a little bit more fair. In San Francisco, I'm Ariella Markowitz.
And I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
You can find and share that story at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. In the fall of 2015, a 23-year-old yoga teacher named Audrey Carey was murdered by three young homeless people in the bushes of Golden Gate Park. Soon after that, they shot and killed 67-year-old therapist Steve Carter while he walked his dog in Marin County. Vivian Ho was a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle at the time. She remembers how San Francisco's drifters and street kids were generally vilified after these crimes. And she wrote a book exploring the trauma that pushes young people to the streets in the first place. KALW's Rose Aguilar sat down on your call to talk with Vivian about that new book, Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. We've got a shortened version of that conversation to share with you right now.
What did you know about street kids before you started interviewing them?
I had no idea about the world I was entering. I thought I had a very vague idea of the homeless culture coming out here. I grew up on the East Coast. I didn't really know anything really about homelessness. The homeless culture is very different on the East Coast. And coming out to the West Coast, people warned me. They told me that the weather is better. Everybody is much more visibly homeless. Like, you know, it's a much different level. And they told me that there are people that were homeless by choice. And people were actually making a choice to be homeless. And people were just free spirits. And, you know, they wanted to live on handouts. And they wanted to be lazy and not do anything with their lives. And much of the book is all about me learning that that was very much not true.
Mm. And you also hear that from people in the Bay Area. You write about this in the book in the comments section under stories about mm-hmm. street kids, especially these horrific murders that happened in 2015.
Everyone kind of looks at them, and that's the hard thing about this. We look at these kids, we see them, and we see these young, capable, able-bodied human beings. And we look at them and we think, you could get a job. You could function in society if you wanted to. So you obviously don't want to, but we don't realize what's happening inside. We don't realize what's happening, what happened to them in the past. We don't realize what kind of traumas they suffered, what sort of ordeals that they're dealing with.
So many people coming to San Francisco to find out who they were or who they are in the 60s, for example. A lot of kids flocked here. What has changed from then to now when we're talking about street kids?
I would say it's the culture has been less accepting. For sure. You know, there was a summer of love atmosphere. There was a time for it where people were really celebrating this sort of culture. People were really into the summer of love. People loved that. And now it's more kind of like a sideshow. The kids that you see in the hate street, you know, you see them as like, oh, like, haha. Like, they're a leftover remnant of the summer of love. But they're still the same kids. They're still the same kids with the same kind of hurts, you know? And that, I think we need to be looking at as a society, that the same hurts and the same trauma that sent those kids to San Francisco all those decades ago for a summer of love is still sending kids here today.
Another main difference is that there are millionaires and billionaires now living in San Francisco. $40 million condos. I mean, these kids live in front of some of these condos.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
So that's also a major change. When mm-hmm. you're talking about how acceptance has changed, can you explore that a bit?
Yeah. It's a little tough, you know, when we have when you have all these tech billionaires and, you know, when they're walking to work and they're walking by all these tent encampments, you know, they don't really want to see them. They don't want to see these kids who are panhandling. They don't want to see these kids who are smelly because they haven't had a shower in a week, or they don't want to see them taking up space. It's hard for these kids to be cast off like this, to be cast off as less than and seen as less than and seen as not human beings. That does a lot to somebody's sense of worth and sense of being. I mean, one thing we don't talk about either is about how even like a day, a night you spend on the streets, what that does to your psyche and what that does to you, and how much more difficult it makes it for you to be able to function in society after spending any amount of time on the streets. Add to that the disdain and the rejection from society, the rejection from this sudden influx of wealth that's coming into the city. And it's a perfect recipe for disaster.
And again, the question you ask is, how do we keep these kids from homelessness in the first place? It seems like, wouldn't you want to reach someone who's 13, 14, so they don't end up on the streets for decades?
But that's where it's really hard. And that's where, you know, I start off my book with a disclaimer, and it's probably the hardest disclaimer for anybody who's a journalist. It's, I do not have the answer.
Right.
Which is like, that was excruciating for me to come to terms with. But I do not have an answer for this, because the problem is, how do we solve youth homelessness? Like, can we solve a broken foster care system? Can we solve abusive parents? Can we solve drug addiction? Can we solve mental health? There's so many factors that go into what drives children into the streets, what drives young people into the streets, and what keeps them there. We don't know. We can't solve everything. So much goes into breaking these kids' souls. All we can really do now is just hope that we can piece them together.
That's Vivian Ho, author of the book Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. And that's a shortened version of her conversation with KALW's Rose Aguilar from Your Call. It was produced by Holly J. McDeed. You can listen to the entire program at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. And now, a story from Uncuffed, our series recorded and edited by incarcerated men at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Sonyika Shakur, formerly known as Monster Cody Scott, was in prison in the early 1990s when he wrote a book that made him famous, Monster, the autobiography of an L.A. gang member. Sonyika has been in and out of custody ever since. He's at Solano State Prison now, but he's expecting to get out this month. Before leaving prison, he went to the Uncuffed studio to talk with producer Brian Thames.
Monster Cody. Few people in life have ever met a real monster. But Cody Scott, the infamous and famous 8-Tray gangster Crip, was a true monster and destroyer. He chronicled and glorified his urban terrorism in a book 20 years ago that made him a millionaire. But today, he is Monster no more.
All right. Morning, brother.
Good morning. J-Moss Bowie. That means good morning in Kiswahili.
Some people have known you as one person. And what was that name that you used to be called?
My street name is Monster.
And your name now, you prefer to be called?
Sonyika. My name is Sonyika Shakur. And Sonyika means unifier, gatherer of his people, Swahili. And Shakur means the thankful. So I'm a thankful gatherer of my people.
That's a beautiful name, brother. You know that, right?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You had a history, but according to what others say, your name fit, right. Your old name. What could have been the turning point for you to even go in this direction?
Actually, I'm still turning. I came from like a middle-class family. Like my godfather's Ray Charles. My father played for the Rams, doing when the Rams were the Rams. My mother, man, she was a hardworking woman. And so we lived in the Crenshaw district before it became the Rolling 60s area. And so I came from that area and that family and that class of people. But my mother moved to a bigger house in 1972. She moved into the heart of the West Side Crips. But while my father was on the football field and Ray was in the studio, my mother was at work, I was in the street. I was looking for surrogates. I was looking for somebody to say, good job. I remember when I was 11, I had been bullied by the school bully, you know. And I walked through the gate and the dude said, man, let me get a dime. And I said, I don't got a dime. I had a dime in my coin pocket. He said, all I find I can have? I said, yeah. I didn't think he was gonna search that pocket. He robbed me. But then he took it a step further and he hit me in the mouth. The next day, I joined a gang.
And how old were you again?
I was 11. On June 15th, 1975, I graduated from the sixth grade. And I went home. I went out the window because my mother wanted me to clean the house up and I didn't want to. So I went out the back window and I found some homies. And they sponsored me in the gang. I got jumped in. I got drunk. I got high. So in one day, I became a graduate, a drug addict, a gang member, and a murderer. And that was the most exciting day of my life.
After you wrote your first book, you sort of reached the financial mountaintop. But you went home more than one time and you came back to prison. What happened, brother? How did you fall off?
I never got the disease of addiction under control. From 84 to 88, I'm in prison. I get out, I go right back to the hood, right back to what's popular. And at that time, what was popular was cocaine. So I got on that, just like before I had gotten on PCP. I'm just lucky that heroin didn't come through there, because I would have got on that. If it comes, I'm going to try it.
You being serious, bro?
I'm being serious, bro. Because I was doing such terrible things that I had begun to not like me. But my real problem has been that I just don't care.
Didn't care or don't care?
I didn't care, because now I'm learning to care. Those of us who are revolutionaries, we use this term revolutionary suicide. And revolutionary suicide usually is, we use that for people who have been criminals or lumping. And then we try to have them transform into revolutionary mentalities to commit class suicide as a criminal and become a proletariat, become a revolutionary. But what happens too, that term can also be used in my situation as I was a criminal, I became a revolutionary, and people expected me to commit class suicide as a successful writer and become a noted author. And to me, I didn't want to go that way. I didn't want to be the go-to guy when they said, what about gangs? Because that's not what it's about.
Just recently, some older brothers have described you using this word, educator.
I knew that if anything was going to transform anybody's mentality, it was going to be education. Because the educator, even while he or she is educating, is being educated.
Absolutely.
It's a dialectical relationship.
Right.
And that has been the main eating point of Monster, that Monster has been eaten away by knowledge of self and kind. But it's been such a long history of contamination that the disease of criminality and self-hate and fratricide is so deep, it's so all-imbuing that it's easier to talk it than to walk it.
Let me share something with you. Excuse me, interrupting you. See, this is what I wanted to do, what's being done right now. I don't know if I told you the name when we got started. I called it Monster No More.
Wow.
Because you speak in life right now. That wasn't what the first part of your life was. Your life was bringing death. You were a destroyer. You weren't just a monster. You were a destroyer.
No doubt. No doubt. With me, I've been in the hole for 30 years. I've been validated for 30 years. I've been out a few months here, a few months there. So people don't know me. They know what they read and they know what they hear. But you're hearing about me through someone else's interpretation who may not even understand the need to change. Nobody really knows me, man.
So who are you?
I am Sanyika Shakur, man. I'm a regular cat, man. I like our culture. I love hip hop, man. I love our sisters. I love kids, man. I love camaraderie. I love being around righteous people, man. I love humor. You know what I mean? I love intelligence. And I've gotten sharper and still getting sharper. But I turned all my energy and all my wit and all my charm and all my intelligence into this one thing, banging. And that's how I became a monster.
That was Sanyika Shakur, formerly known as Cody Scott. He spoke with Brian Thames, a producer in KALW's radio program at Solano State Prison. And we have a big announcement to make. Today, we are publicly launching Uncuffed as its own podcast. It'll feature voices from Solano and San Quentin State Prisons. The men put together a trailer. Let's take a listen.
We rolling.
Man, let's get this thing cracking.
Let's
y'all.
Get it.
Bring it.
Let's do it.
What?
Coming at you from Solano State Prison in the rolling hills of the Golden State.
And from the Bay of San Francisco at San Quentin State Prison.
This is Uncuffed.
Uncuffed is about telling our stories from our perspective.
from the perspective of a person who hasn't had his story told.
We bring them down to the studio, we record them, and then we edit it ourselves.
On the show, you'll hear what it's like to be incarcerated.
From the minute you stepped in the building, you literally felt that you was kind of like on this other planet.
But really, what it's like to be a human being.
To struggle with your family.
If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad.
Or to try something new that you never imagined doing.
30 guys from all different cliques and gangs doing yoga on the handball court.
For those of you who have been to prison and those of you who haven't, and for those of you who don't know anybody that's ever been in prison, whoever you are, we want you to get to know who we are.
When you've been deprived of speaking, of talking, for years on end, and someone says all of a sudden, hey man, I'm gonna tell your story. There is where the magic began.
We want to let the people know that you're powerful, that your voice matters, that you can speak up, that you can make a difference in this world.
We've got the mic now, and we're telling our own stories.
Uncuffed, from San Quentin and Solano State Prison and KLW Public Radio. Subscribe now in any podcast player.
Let's get crack-a-lackin'.
Here we roll.
No, not the crack-a-lackin'.
You scale the charts.
That was the trailer for the Uncuffed podcast, which you can now subscribe to in major podcast apps. Go ahead and be one of the first to do it. Episode 1 will go live in 2 weeks. KALW's work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Thank you for listening to KALW. We are listener-supported public radio, and we're here for you. Show your support at KALW.org. For CrossCurrents, I'm Ben Trefney.